Well, I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Wurzel from the University of Orbis, who's studying here in Oxford this term. And he's going to talk to us about his approach on philosophy as a meta language in Turkic studies.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank Bjarne for letting me have this opportunity to speak in front of so many gifted people. Before I start, I will say that because of this limited time that I have, it would be kind of a tour de force of my ideas, so I hope you're ready. And excuse for my boring PowerPoint. First off, I think it's important to explain why I want to do these things and why it's important, and I think a positioning will be on its place. And especially for this peculiar match of Heidegger and the Nietzsche-Tantan. I come from a background of religious studies, and I have a minor in philosophy as well, so that's why the philosophy thing. One of the reasons why I chose this was when I started learning Sanskrit, and I started especially getting into the tantric traditions. I found that the more general and universalistic models of the religious studies were rather insufficient for the way I wanted to work with this subject matter and this tradition and this intellectual thought. So I wasn't in need of more models. I was more in need of a new kind of language that could describe or talk about what was going on instead of trying to categorize everything. So for me, this encounter with this foreign, this radical foreign thing, always seemed to leave the academia in two extreme positions. One would be the more hardcore Indologists that would try to use as much as the tradition's own words, in more or less in fear of destroying its meaning by translating it. But this, for me, ended up more like a theology or an exegesis that, in the end, didn't really broaden anything for me. The other position, the one I'm from, is the comparative traditions of the religious studies, especially in Aarhus, where these rigid models were, that started out mostly as Judeo-Christian models, were made to fit all cultures and were more or less just forcing these different ideas into them, and that was the thing I was trying to escape from. So my thing is, how do you create a comparative language that, without unreflectingly borrowing from the same vocabulary as the before-mentioned Judeo-Christian models, and how do you not get seduced by the Indologist's way of not translating the key notions of things and leaving them untranslatable. How do you create a language that can be used to study another culture and maybe actually borrow some of the other culture's MX models and in a form of dialectic relationship can use these notions actually to shed light on one's own culture? For me, this came with an acceptance that I could never gain a perfect knowledge of the foreign, but I can enter a dialogue with foreign culture. I would argue, as a part of a religious studies and not an Indology, the acceptance of this impossibility of an empathic understanding, and if you accept this impossibility, you'll actually be left with an enormous potential. And if the research is self-aware and transparent, then this method could illuminate new areas of both the researcher and the researched in the study of religion in general. So to round up my positioning, I'm not rejecting any of the before-mentioned disciplines. Instead, I'm trying to create a bridging meta-language that can borrow from both places. So trying to create a dialogical or dialectic that can actually make Indian IMIC models applicable for ethic models into Western conceptions, and thus hopefully shedding light on both areas at the same time. So another thing is, why the philosophical angle, and why use Heidegger, that is known for being so unclear, to try to understand something so obscure as tantric religion, this question has actually been used as an argument against my positioning a couple of times now, and of course there's a great truth to that, but at the same time, this is not a new kind of model I'm proposing, in which you can again try to make the new foreign fit. It's for me, and that's why I'm focusing on the language. It is a meta-language. It's a new way of talking and engaging in conversation with the foreign, and that's the important. And that's why I actually went with the philosophical angle, because much of these dialectic and dialogical aspects are present in the more philosophical discourse. I'm basing everything I'm talking about right now is to narrow it down based on three passages from the seventh chapter of the Nyanatantra. It's my own translation, so if you find anything you're disagreeing with, we can always talk about it. But I'll come to that later on. And the last thing of why using Heidegger and philosophy is actually to use the argument that was used against me as my strength. Because the subject matter is so obscure, then why not use an as unclear a philosopher as Heidegger to elucidate it? And that's why I'm trying to use him. And don't worry, this is not a Heidegger talk. For me, it's just trying to speed talk through why and how I will use these concepts. Mostly focused on Dasein, Zuhanden, and Angst. So Dasein is Heidegger's way of rewriting the subject. And this is very important for me, because his subject no longer stands outside the world, but is in constant engaging in it. This is because of the Dasein's character of being in the world, and it cannot otherwise be it. So you can say that it's Dasein's ontological status is its involvement with the world. So this idea of rewriting, also the tantric practitioner, so that he's no longer a subject observing, but a Dasein that is constant engaging in the world and with the world, I think fits these practitioners well, mostly because of his basis in the practical activities of yoga and so forth, jhana and pranayama. So that he actually, these practical activities in the world can be used as a mean to gain what he wishes. So the main importance here is not agnostic, again, a worn-out term, self, but a more active self that is grounded in the world. The next point is the Zuhanden, and this is what the Dasein engages with. We, as Daseins, can engage with it because it approaches us. You could call it phenomenons if you want to. So through this engagement or involvement, we have what he calls a Bewandtnis, a way of involving ourselves with it. The Zuhanden and the totality of these Zuhanden approaching us makes up what he calls the Bewandtnis Ganzheit, which again is the world. So to rephrase it, how we involve ourselves with the things around us affects the totality of the world as we perceive it. So our engagement with things affects our worldview. This idea of involvement is especially interesting when you look at how the tantric, again, practitioner perceives his own body, but I will go in depth through that in a moment. The next is angst. That's a borrowed term from Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, and both of them view angst as a potentially positive thing. This is because when you use it correctly, you can be able to create this space for actions where the Dasein can choose itself in its absolute certainty, to use a Kierkegaard quote. It can choose itself as its authentic self. But why can it do this? As we saw before, the world is what approaches us and what we involve us with. When the angst occurs, it has the character of nowhere. And this nowhere makes angst impossible to have a relentless with, to involve yourself with. Therefore, the Dasein is to reconsider the world, making and the angst makes the world transparent, so thereby the Dasein gets confronted with itself in this meaninglessness of the space that angst creates. In this confrontation, the what Heidegger calls Selbstsein können occurs. And that means that the Dasein is now free to choose itself on its own terms, and that unleashes an enormous potential. It's much like the tantric practitioner when he has reached the higher level of consciousness. The Heideggerian Selbstsein können is the tantrika's siddha or jivanmukta condition. Now I have some of the prints of the text I've been translating. So if you look at chapter 7, 1 to 5, I will try to see if I can utilize this new vocabulary. So from verse 1 to 5, the different part of the esoteric body is mentioned. There is this sequence of six, it's the chakra system, but it's called the sequence of six. The vowel supports the three objects of focus, and this, the fivefold space, we will come in, we'll talk about that later, but this is actually a very important point for me because of the ka suffix in Viona Panchaka. It's the only of the numerals that are actually in abstract form, making this five-folded space. And contrary to other translations, it's not voids, it's spaces in my translation. I'm not using Kishan Maharaj's commentary. Then the 12 knots, the three shaktis could be referring to either the activity, consciousness and will. It could also just connect to Yamuna, Ganga and Saraswati. I don't know yet, but if you have any good comments on that, that would be nice. Then the path of the three abodes and the three nadis. So what is interesting here is that it starts out with saying the Lord spoke, now I will proclaim the highest supreme and subtle visualizing meditation, the jhana, which comprises of the sequence of six. So interesting thing here is, again, if we keep in mind that the Suhanten is something that appears for the Dasein, so the esoteric anatomy could be this Suhanten. Again, because of his focus on this esoteric anatomy is not something that is in the body, but it's something that occurs when he starts talking about the visualization, the jhana. So the esoteric body is not connected with the body, but it's this jhana. So you can see it in a dimension again. So it's not the body that comprises of these things. It's more or less a technique where you kind of visual map your own body with it. So this Suhanten enables the yogic practitioner to work with his own body, but even more important, to utilize it as a tool, a soik, and in controlling the different aspects of his reality. So his body, his etheric body is now an instrument used to alter this reality. His usage of the body as a tool is to some extent dictated by the yogi's bewandtnis with it, or even more so in his place in the bewandtnis ganzheit of approaching Suhanten. So in other words, the relation to his own body affects and alters his relation to the world. This would also make the world a yogic representation, not an imaginative, but a multi-layered reality, or as I will speak of later, a more saturated reality. So all in all, this idea of the esoteric anatomy, not as Julian talked about before, not as connected to different organs in the body, but actually more or less something that you are in, you are engaging with. So the esoteric anatomy is a tool in order to control your own body and thereby also altering the world around you. The next verses. Oh, sorry. I don't know why that's there. We'll take that later. The next verses is 27 to 29. And here he goes into depth with two systems. The first one is the Vyomas, again the spaces and the chakras. And he mentions their name and their places. So there are six chakras. And as we talked about before, there is this fivefold space. This becomes more clear through the indicator in verse 27 in the first part, where it's called Kam Anantam. Sorry. And this is the endless space, hinting at an infinite space that lies beyond or above, who knows. Another is the grammar in what we'll see later in the verse 21, both A, part A and part D, where the support and the fivefold places, which relates to each other, is both in singular. This seems very deliberate, that every time the mention of this space is, it's always in a singular and always in this abstract form. So this idea of a fivefold space may seem quite radical, but there are reasons too why I would argue that when it comes to this space, it is justifiable, this way of looking at it. First off, the body is a three-dimensional, and then it must, then also the esoteric anatomy must be as well. So when we have this idea of an esoteric mapping of a three-dimensional aura, so we have to see this esoteric mapping of the body as three-dimensional or holographic. You can also see that in other traditions, this idea of having different aspects of looking at the body. For example, this is only a side note, for example, the Buddhist idea of a stupa and a mandala. The mandala you can see it in two different ways, or the Sri Yanta in the Sri Vijaya tradition. Again, both of them have possible aspects of looking at the same body. It all depends on the way you look at it and the way you use the body. The body is not a model, but it's something organic and something which should be understood through practical experience. It is a Dasein engaging with its own Suhanden. It should be added again, just to clarify, that this is for me not the voids, and it makes a huge difference that I use space instead of voids, because these voids seem more, as we'll see in the next slide, but if we translate them as voids, they seem more of having a Buddhist idea of nothingness, where I see them more as a total involvement with everything in this, so a kind of unity thought. The last example I have, again, it's 30 to 34, and here is the synonyms for the fivefold place mentioned. In verse 32, the yogi is told to find the Kechara Mudra. And here I ran into some difficulties. Why it's called Kechara, this mudra, it's very often called Kechari. I have no idea why it's in masculine right now. But another thing that annoyed me even more is that if you look further down, you see the line in, in the last words in the verse 34 is called Yogini Samarasi Aved, which is a very interesting thing, that all the text I've read so far, you always become one with the male god or the some kind of the it's a masculine goal you're trying to obtain through this feminine technique called Kichari. But for some reason here, the roles are turned, so you use a masculine technique, he who roams in space, to actually become a she, a yogini. I don't have any answers right now why that would be, but it's again an interesting shift. You can see in a later manuscript of the same Nitya Tantra, there is, I think it's from the 1700s, 1800s, they actually switched it again, so you have the same essence as a yogi, so they corrected or tried to cover what's happening here, but I can't really go into detail with what the shift is about. But the important thing still is that the Kechara Mudra enables the yogi to travel to the highest and ultimately become the goddess, him or herself. So the question is, how is this possible for the yogi to be able to reach this highest state? I would argue that, to take another Hegelian term, that the angst we talked about before is not in a tantric context as extreme a condition to be in, mostly because of the strict physical training the practitioner goes through and the constant realization of yourself as part of everything and not as a single isolated individual. Whereas with Kierkegaard and Heidegger, the angst is something that comes from nowhere and attacks the unprepared person. With the tantrika, the notion of the empty nowhere is not a frightening thought anymore, but it is the goal for the practice to the dissolution. Hence, it does not paralyze them, but frees them to become this divine body, this divine body they actually need to travel in these spaces we talked about before in the body. So in this forced or controlled anxiety they bring themselves in, they actually choose themselves in there. Again, Heideggerian Einlichkeit, so they choose their own divinity and their own power over the body. With this divine body, they can use the Kechara to move in this fivefold space of the esoteric body, the space in the body that works as an interface, it seems, for the cosmos, again reflecting at the micro-macrocosmos between the body and the universe. In this freedom that the angst bring about, the yogic practitioner realizes the unity of the cosmos and uses his Suhanten as a tool to control the world through his Bewandtnis Ganzheit. He is therefore able to move in space that is truly the endless space. Because of this realization of his own Suhanten, he can use his esoteric body as a tool to manipulate his own body and the cosmos and the reality. So his reality becomes more saturated because of his ability to experience this space that is both in the body and outside, and actually experience it in its own spaceness. He's no longer in need of creating places from the Bewandtnis Ganzheit of the Suhanten. Now he's truly free. The fivefold space is thus hinting at the endless space that the yogi can enter by the means of the Kechara. And there is a double meaning in this space, because it could also mean heaven or ether. Thus, operating in this space, it seems as it is, again, an interface between the world of different Suhantens, in other words, a situated place, and the saturated reality, which is the space beyond place, a space outside place and time.
Thank you.